From a new convention center to the next steps for the shipyards and a whole lot more. Just ahead, a look at the future of downtown development. Good Wednesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or through the WJCT app. Just ahead, a conversation with Andre Wallace, CEO of the Downtown Investment Authority, and there is a lot to talk about. What are your questions about so many projects? It's your chance now to connect with Andre. Get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, local survivors join those around the world in an international remembrance of the Holocaust. Plus, recognizing the city's top teachers, we'll spotlight the Eddie Awards, all of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, a slew of urban core projects is finally moving ahead this 2018 first quarter. It's long-awaited positive news for downtown boosters who've been hoping for years to see some dirt turning in downtown Jacksonville. Now, here's one to talk about. Earlier this month, the Jacksonville Downtown Investment Authority approved to seek requests for proposals, RFPs, to see if any private investors might be interested in building a new convention center and hotel. It's intended to go on the site of the old county courthouse and City Hall Annex on Bay Street. Those buildings would be torn down. And, of course, plenty of other projects are in the works, too. Everything from what Shad Khan wants to do at the shipyards and in and around the sports complex to the district project on the South Bank, the Laura Street Trio project, a new Hotel Indigo planned for downtown, new apartments going up in the La Villa district, and a lot more. There is a lot to go through here. So right now we're pleased to welcome Andre Wallace. He's CEO of the city's Downtown Investment Authority. Andre, always good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good morning, Melissa.
Lots of calls coming in already. When it comes to the urban core and all of these projects that are in the works, in the pipeline, what are your questions? What are your thoughts? Give us a call, 549-2937. The number to join the show, 549-2937, or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page. And so you met last week and voted unanimously your board to issue those RFPs for the new convention center. Those will go out probably next month. You're hoping for some bids, right?
That is correct. I sought the approval of the board to release a notice of disposition. Some people may know it as a request for proposal to develop a hotel, public convention center space, as well as an actual parking garage. So we're seeking at a minimum of a 350-room hotel, roughly about 200,000 square feet of convention center space with about a 40,000 square foot ballroom, 45 individual breakout rooms, and a parking garage of roughly about 1,700 parking spaces.
How critical do you see this project in terms of spurring further urban core foot traffic, development, other ancillary projects, restaurants, bars, boutique shops, the works, everything that you would hope a convention center might attract?
Certainly. One of the things that we're certainly looking at with the potential of a new convention center is being able to have connectivity to our present sports complex, which we're vastly working towards trying to have an entertainment district. So when you bring those two pieces together, it certainly gives the retail and nightlife component customers. And that's the big thing. When you go to different cities and you go to conventions, there's one thing for what I call the 8 to 5 on an actual convention, but everybody wants to know what happens from 6 p.m. until. And so I think having a convention center more so in the urban core than where it is today will certainly help us spur that particular type of growth.
Right. Okay. So that's one big project, and you're hoping for RFPs. This project would cost in the hundreds of millions. Do you see this as a tough sell to convince a developer to put down that kind of money, given that the area around where the new convention center would go is still sort of, you know, in flux, as they say?
This is an opportunity for us to understand what the market is going to tell us. So we're hoping to see a number of different proposals come in. We've certainly asked them to put their financial package together and certainly tell us if there are anything in terms of assistance that they will be seeking from the public sector, to tell us what that would actually be. So we're going to certainly listen to what the market says. We're highly interested in terms of what the design would actually look at, and the connectivity, again, between connecting the urban core with the actual sports complex and entertainment district to come.
Okay, and then let's talk about the sports complex and everything Jaguars owner Shad Khan has proposed to do with the Shipyards parcel, which is just down the street a little bit, down Bay Street a little bit from where you'd like the new convention center to go. How excited are you about Khan's vision? How do you see this interconnectivity, hopefully transforming this entire stretch of downtown Jacksonville, if all of this comes to fruition?
The excitement is great. The ability to bring these type of attractions together, as other cities have done, from a professional standpoint, is very intriguing for us to work on. And they definitely complement each other. When I look back in 2014, when we did our market study for downtown, one of the things they talked about is making sure that your sports, entertainment, convention, all of that comes together. So we are following our market study, following our CRA plan, and bringing these pieces together. So we're very excited about what we're seeing right now.
Is there another comparable medium market city with a major sports franchise you can point to, Andre, that another playbook you could point to that's done this type of urban core renaissance that people could look at?
Two cities. You can certainly look at Nashville.
Nashville.
You can certainly look at Charlotte. Both of them are bookend from a stadium and an actual convention center. So when you look at it from that standpoint, you know, we're learning from what other cities have done well. It just so happened that we're in the present today being able to bring that to fruition.
And the Chamber just did a trip up to Charlotte, didn't they?
Well, the Chamber did a trip to Charlotte in 2013.
Okay.
And we went to Nashville, if I'm not mistaken, would have been 2014.
Okay, so it's been a little while.
Years. Yes.
All right, and so before we go to calls for the DIA Chief, Andre Wallace, the number 549-2937, a couple more questions for you. The district project on the South Bank, developer Peter Rummel, is going back to his original plan. There had been this unusual deal in which your agency, the DIA, was going to purchase this 30-acre parcel from JEA. After that got reported, there was some pushback from some city council members. Now it appears that this is going to be financed largely via private funds. And so can you bring us up to speed on how or if that project will proceed?
Certainly. The developer chose to discuss with JEA with regards to the developer purchasing the property. And if there's an incentive that they're actually going to seek, then they'll come back to the table and work with us. So they worked out whatever arrangement that they needed to work out with JEA. But what I want people to understand is the Downtown Investment Authority had no involvement in the Jacksonville Electric Authority's request for proposal process for how they selected the developers, nor what agreements they would enter into.
Why would the DIA vote to buy that land from another city agency? That came in for a fair amount of criticism. The city buying land from itself, in effect.
When you're working on projects such as this, we have the fiduciary responsibility, first and foremost, to protect the taxpayer. And in order to protect the taxpayer, it gets down to what's the security, what's the collateralization position that we would be in the event that a project were to stall, fail, would not move forward. In order to get comfortable with doing that, we propose to control the real estate. So if you, the developer, failed, we would still be in control of the actual real estate itself. Instead of you controlling the real estate and we're putting money in, and then we'd have to end up going through litigation and things of that nature to try to get our resources back in the event that the project failed. So this is clearly from us a security collateralization position for us and having you, the developer, in a performance-based incentive package.
What would you say to critics of how this all went down, that it looked like a sweetheart deal for the developer, Mr. Rummel, and that the only reason it's ended up now the way it is because the Florida Times Union got wind of it? and that there had not been much transparency behind it, that it was being done without the proper sunshine. Because this does involve millions of taxpayer dollars, after all.
First and foremost, the Downtown Investment Authority for three consecutive years had set aside money for investment into that particular site. So that was clearly in the sunshine, clearly transparent, 100%. When you're sitting down and negotiating a project, you are always looking for the best leverage that you can get. So from a critical standpoint, you know, when you're negotiating, people are going to have their various different opinions, but I get paid to make sure I protect the taxpayer, and that is exactly the proposal that we put on the table, was the best proposal to protect the taxpayer, provided that we were going to invest in that particular project. Now that the developer's proposing to purchase the land, going back to the original agreement that they had agreed to with JEA, we'll still be back at the table should they seek an incentive. And still the two things that we're going to be discussing is security collateralization as well as performance, which is the build out of the actual site. So those two issues will still be back on the table.
If you could define performance a little bit more fully for
performance means that you're going to build what you're actually proposing.
And the proof is in the pudding on that, right? We'll have to see. All righty. And lots of calls for Andre Wallace. He heads up the city's Downtown Investment Authority. What are your thoughts, comments, questions? 549-2937. Let's go to Leslie in San Jose. Hey, Leslie, good morning.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
I am actually riding down the road with my 14-year-old, and I thought I'd bring in his perspective. As he was listening, he said, "Mom, I've heard about this talk about downtown my whole life." And my response was, "I've lived here 40 years, and I've heard it as well. And my parents have lived here 70 years, and I hear about, you know, the way they talk about how it was thriving in the 60s when they worked downtown." But so my 14-year-old and I, we have the question, is this just wishful thinking or is this something that will actually come to fruition one day?
Okay. Thank you for that. And of course, that's a question that we get asked by listeners, Andre. Whenever we do this topic, people are tired of the talk. And I know you get this question a lot, too. They want to see vertical construction or they want to see build outs. And to give credit where credit is due, there are some build-outs going on right now downtown. But what about her question?
Her question first. Redevelopment is not easy. And you have to have a combination of private sector funds with some public sector funds in order to do that. For some time, the city was not in a position to put public sector funds available because we had to address the pension issue. Now we're able to do just that. Still, you have to bring the private sector along, and in order for the private sector to do it, they have to be able to see that they're going to make a rate of return on their actual projects. So what you're seeing now is great development going on in the LaVille area. You've seen development take place in the Brooklyn neighborhood. You've seen the Laura Street Trio Barnett Building project being launched. You're seeing Florida State College of Jacksonville's project being launched in downtown. You're seeing 264 units of apartments being built on the riverfront right next to the school board. So in a short period of span of 2 years, you've got well over 1,000 units of residential being constructed.
Andrew on the south side. Hello, Andrew.
Yes, ma'am. How you doing?
Ma'am? Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
Yes, ma'am. My question is concerning downtown blight. Specifically, the old Parkview Inn Motel right there at the corner of Main Street, I believe it's Union. First question is, does the city own the property? And the second question is, if it is privately owned, is there any idea of what's going to happen with it?
Yes, sir. I understand exactly what you're talking about.
Okay, yeah.
To answer your first question, no, the property is not owned by the city of Jacksonville. Second, the property is being marketed right now. There's a potential development opportunity there for multifamily residential housing that we'd certainly like to see come to fruition. I just want to be clear with the caller. The property happens to fall just one block outside of the boundary of downtown.
Huh.
So I'm unable to really work on that particular site. However, I encourage my colleagues at the Office of Economic Development in the city's neighborhood department, whatever they can do to help from a development standpoint to see that project.
Interesting.
Come to fruition.
And if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Andre Wallace. He heads up the city's Downtown Investment Authority. The number to join us, 549-2937. Lots of calls. We'll get to a few more of your calls about all of these projects in the pipeline in just a moment. And that caller wanted to know about what he thought was a city-held property. Here's an email about that for you, Andre, from Bill in Springfield. The Snyder Memorial Building, a beautiful former church, is owned by the city and has sat mostly unused for years, despite its prime downtown location. An RFP was issued last year, but no update since. What is the outlook for the Snyder Building, and why does it take so long to move city-owned real estate back on the tax roll? And that brings up another point. There are so many buildings like that that are on the city blocks. I think the Times Union did another story about that. All of these buildings that are owned by the city that really are sitting vacant that ideally would be bought up by private developers and private businesses would be doing something with. So what about that piece of this downtown puzzle?
Okay, let's dispel the myth that the city is sitting on an ownership of a lot of city-owned property.
You dispute that story?
Yes, I do.
Reported that the city owned, I think they said, over 1,500 properties.
But 1,500 properties, are they all within downtown? Let's address that particular question fairly. With regards to Snyder Memorial, yes, the board did talk about going out for an actual RFP. We did not go out with that RFP at that time. We're looking to go out with an RFP between late spring, early summer this year on Snyder Memorial itself. That's one of the things that we're looking to do. But also the other city-owned assets that are most known, I just got approval last week to go out for the old city hall and old courthouse.
Right.
So that leaves us with 324 Broad Street, which is a property that had gone out for bid that we will be going back out probably in the spring equally as well, seeking other proposals there. So that leaves us roughly about 814 or 816 Davis Street, which is about a two-block parcel with that had a restaurant that was started. It's known as the Old Sac Seafood Site, that we will be looking to go out with a request for proposal spring, summer as well.
So when it comes to your footprint, your downtown footprint, how many buildings does the city own that you would like to issue RFPs for?
I've just gone over. So it's roughly 324 West Broad Street and about 814 or 816 Davis Street. Those are the other two parcels that I'm definitely going to be coming up with an RFP this year. Now, in the La Villa area, vacant parcels, which tend to be parking lots for Jaguar football games, but those lots are very close to the Jacksonville Regional Transportation Center, where between JTA and DIA later this year, we're going to collectively take about five blocks of property, put it together, and come up with a request for proposal for development there.
So the reporting that was done a month or two ago that indicated that there are hundreds of city-owned properties sitting vacant, you're saying those are countywide, not necessarily in the urban core footprint?
I'm very familiar with the properties that from the Downtown Investment Authority that we have under our management, and I do not know of 100 properties that we have under our management.
All right, let's go to Richard downtown. Go ahead, Richard.
Yes, first I'd like to say that I think Mr. Wallace has done a stellar job since he's been in his position. I'm a lifetime resident of Jacksonville and a long-time business downtown Jacksonville. And these huge projects are just wonderful, and it's going to really do a lot to bring downtown back. But my question is this. Until those projects really are completed, is anything being done to help the precious few merchants that are downtown to let them hold on until some of these things come online? I think we're in desperate need of someone to tell our problems to that can be addressed and can be solved. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, thanks for that question.
I mean, Richard, you can, if you've got some questions, feel free to call my office, 630-3487. That's my office number. And we can address your questions from a merchant standpoint. I'm not sure if your question is related to because there is development taking place and it may be obstructing parking, which is making it difficult for your customers to get to you. And sometimes if there's road improvement projects, that also makes it difficult for customers to get to you. But I'd certainly want to talk to you about what your challenges are and see what we can possibly do and what avenues and programs we can actually create.
Brandy in Riverside. Hi, Brandy.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thanks.
Great, thanks. I, along with so many others, especially in the Riverside area, want to live downtown. We honestly, especially the young millennial, we want to live in our urban core. However, without a grocery store, we won't make that plunge. Like, I've been sitting on the cuff of moving downtown for about 3 years now, and you know, I do my little drive-throughs, and I will never go anywhere where I can't walk to a grocery store, especially in an urban area where we want to park our cars and not touch them until, you know, we go out of town. That's how we want to live. So I guess I get a little bit more discouraged when there's, like, things that are really investing in, like, outsiders coming in, partying it up for the night, and then leaving. There's no one there nurturing the, like the last caller just said, the local community. Like, that doesn't benefit the local community when people come in, party, go to a concert, and walk out. We need people to live in downtown, and we need a Publix downtown. We need a Publix smack dab in the middle, right near Hemming Plaza. Publix, you hear this. That's what we need.
All right. Thanks, Brandy. Any hope for Brandy?
Considering it on the, what I'd call the edges of downtown.
There's a Harvey's.
You have a Harvey's.
Yeah.
And then you've got Fresh Market.
Yeah.
So, but I think what, if I address Brandy's question correctly, I think Brandy is saying right in the urban core of downtown, she's seeking an actual grocery store. Well, I would have to say, as we produce more residential accommodations, more residential units in our urban core, we'll be able to attract that particular grocery store.
John tweets us, what are the biggest hindrances? Population, transportation, et cetera. Well, as you just pointed out, retail follows rooftops, right? That's always the mantra. The more people you can get to move in, the more businesses will follow. Here's a tweet from Mike. Please put a music club or restaurant like House of Blues in the Snyder Memorial Church. I know that's probably not the first time you've gotten that
suggestion. No, that is not the first suggestion. Time I've heard that one. But yeah. Hopefully once we release the request for proposal, someone would come with that concept.
Jason is in San Marco. Hi, Jason. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I just got a question. Recently heard, I guess you guys were talking about the entertainment downtown area. Recently heard the DIA was considering an open container policy similar to Savannah or New Orleans. I was just wondering what the progress was that, if that was even being considered.
Okay. I hadn't heard that, but is that being discussed?
I was wondering if Jason was in my office. my staff and I have that conversation on an ongoing basis. You know, that's going to take a little bit more work with us.
So we were discussing it.
Yeah, no, we did discuss that internally. And it may have been discussed at a meeting where I know Councilwoman Boyer brought Sports and Entertainment Department, JSO, together. It may very well have come up there. But we certainly believe that as we move forward with more connectivity between hopefully the urban core and the sports complex, that at some point in time we begin to have that type of a conversation.
Tom on the west side. Go ahead, Tom.
Good morning. What I was curious about is I was wondering if there was any future possibilities for the GAA building should they wind up vacating that.
Right. What's going to become of the JEA Tower?
The early discussions that we had, should JEA vacate where they are and build a new facility somewhere, that JEA would, one, market the property for purchase. If they got no takers, one of the things would be the discussion about demolishing and clearing that particular site. I'm going to footnote it now. There will be a contingent of our population that feels like it's a historic building that would certainly not be in favor of that. But I must say the following. Whatever happens, we do not want that particular block to have two properties that are just sitting there empty, nothing going on, because we've had that issue at 233 West Duval where JEA used to be, vacated that and moved to where they are, and we have a building that's been dormant for quite some time. So we're going to have a mental maturation about what happens with that particular site.
I like that phrase, mental maturation. You know, I could apply that to so many situations. Thanks for that, Andre. And Courtney tweets the show, turn the landing into a grocery store. Similar buildings work in many other downtown areas. We didn't even get to the Jacksonville Landing. We'll have to save that for another round. I know you'll enjoy that one, right? Andre Wallace, CEO of the Downtown Investment Authority. Always great to see you, and thank you so much for being with us. We couldn't even get through so many calls waiting to connect with you, but I'm sure you can connect with Andre. Search him out online. He is always receptive, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me, Melissa.
Thank you. Much more still ahead later, honoring this area's top teachers. We'll also tell you about a citywide day of service coming up soon, Generation Works. But up next, local survivors commemorate International Holocaust Memorial Day. Back in a moment.
A lot of things can happen when the lights go out.
They allowed these women for years to be abused.
For janitors, working the night shift is dangerous, even in the era of Me Too.
They need to take extra steps. They can't just wait until the next rape happens.
On the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hello, I'm Doug Hansard, and I listen to the Florida Times Union On Demand as read by WJCT Radio Reading Service volunteers. The sound quality is excellent. This is a great asset for people like me, sightless and on the go. The Florida Times Union Daily on the radio reading website at wjct.org/radio reading. Take advantage of it, and while you're there, register as a listener.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. The best in classic and modern blues as part of WJCT's After Hours. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
I don't want no woman telling me what to do.
Welcome back. Well, this Saturday marks International Holocaust Memorial Day. First designated by the United Nations, the goal of this day is to make sure the memory of the Holocaust is kept alive for future generations to prevent genocide from ever happening again. Sadly, this has become a more urgent need than ever before. A disturbing rise in anti-Semitism is being documented right now in this country and overseas in a series of incidents around the world. Third-generation Holocaust survivor Dana Rogozinski grew up in Jacksonville, and she joins us now with more about International Holocaust Memorial Day this weekend. Dana, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being with us, and your family was so touched by this. Your grandparents survived Auschwitz and Birkenau, correct?
Correct.
So you grew up with these stories.
I did, yes. My grandparents, my grandmother really started speaking in the early 90s of sharing her story and sharing her past.
Not before that?
No, not before that.
And so what did she tell you?
She told me how difficult it was, how hard life was. Life was wonderful in the beginning of her life in Czechoslovakia. And when she was the age of 12 is really when the Nazi regime started taking over and removing them from schools. And that was really the start of her new normal in her new life. And it wasn't until 1945 when she survived and was liberated that she was able to restart over everything.
And in fact, this day on Saturday is the anniversary of the liberation of these camps, isn't it?
Yes. So Auschwitz-Birkenau, that was liberated on January 27th in 1945. And then there was another Auschwitz concentration camp that was liberated in April.
There are a number of Holocaust survivors in this area, it's my understanding as well.
There are. There's actually around 85, 95 in the whole Northeast Jacksonville to Palm Coast area.
And it's so important to talk about this. You're the granddaughter of Holocaust survivors. So this is personal for you, but even for people who aren't Jewish or are only passing curious about this, I think it's so important to talk about this because we are watching unfold before our eyes this huge spike in anti-Semitism. We saw this rally in Charlottesville, Virginia recently where white supremacists marched with torches in the manner of the Ku Klux Klan, and a young woman was killed, and they marched and they chanted slogans like, "You will not replace us," meaning white people won't be replaced by people of color. And then they said, "Jews will not replace us." This is horrifying.
It's very hard to watch, you know, knowing that not only my grandparents, but so many families around the world have gone through this. And you try to learn from history so you don't repeat it. And it's difficult to see and to know that there's no reason for it, but it's happening.
Yes. And, you know, you think of anti-Semitism as something that was a scourge of the past. But history teaches that it can flare up again. And so the goal of this occasion that the United Nations designated is simply to promote education.
Absolutely. I think we need to educate not only the young children who are going to be our future, but I think we need to educate every age group, because it can start, you know, from the bottom up or it can start from the top down. And I think it's really important to understand love and tolerance and peace as opposed to hate.
And so what sort of educational efforts are taking place in Florida and around the world this weekend to commemorate this day?
So this weekend in Jacksonville, there's not too much going on. However, there is a international campaign. It's called the We Remember campaign. It's the largest Holocaust remembrance campaign that's going on. And if you, for International Holocaust Remembrance Day, if you take a photo of yourself holding a sign and it says "We Remember," and you post it on social media and use the hashtag WeRemember and email it, if you want to WeRemember@WJC.org. That's bringing awareness, and they're hoping that it goes viral so that it brings awareness to the Holocaust and to the hate that happened so that we don't repeat it.
So people on social media this Saturday, they need to look for the hashtag WeRemember. Mm-hmm. And if you're so motivated, just take a picture of yourself holding up a sign with that hashtag, WeRemember.
Yep. Yes.
It's a simple way to be part of this campaign.
Very simple.
Anybody can do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're trying to reach out to everyone that we know around the world to join us in doing this so that we bring awareness and that we never forget.
Again, that hashtag is WeRemember. You can be part of that campaign, that social media campaign this Saturday. It's International Holocaust Memorial Day. And in this time of rising hatred and anti-Semitism, you know, it's more important than ever to raise your voice to combat that. So Jacksonville resident Dana Roguzinski, your family, of course, was touched by the Holocaust. So we so appreciate you sharing this with our listeners. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for this opportunity. It's so important, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, later in the hour, we're going to spotlight the top teachers in town. But up next, how you can be part of Generation Works. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9.
guy came up on a bike behind me and tried to grab my phone. And so we started wrestling. I got my phone back. And I thought, okay, that's it. That's the end of this. But it wasn't.
Lessons from a Mugging and Other True Stories in a live show from Dublin, Ireland. Next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we ask the tough questions and we take no guff, not even, from NPR's own Terry Gross.
Is there something that you love that would surprise people to know?
Oh, well, it might be opera, because I surprise myself to know I like it.
Nobody here is surprised to know that you like it. Don't be bringing that nonsense around here. We have plenty of our own. Join us for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR. Saturday and Sunday mornings on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Jazz Night in America, Fred Hirsch, the poet pianist, and his piece dealing with the poetry of Walt Whitman, Leaves of Grass.
Or sometimes when I meet people and they say, that Whitman album helped me get through a really terrible time in my life. And I'd like to think that it's, you know, humbly because of the music, but it's also it's the words.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's a dedicated day of service led by women and girls, and men and boys are welcome too, of course. And the objective is to bring sustainable change and impact to all of our neighborhoods here in Northeast Florida. The idea is to bring together hundreds of volunteers to wire, weld, wash, hammer, and work their magic to transform our city. Generation Works is coming up with a whole range of citywide projects to benefit dozens of local nonprofits. Now, this is all happening Saturday, February 3rd, and it's a project of Generation W, the Women's Leadership Initiative here in Jacksonville. Here with a preview, founder Donna Orender. Good morning.
Woohoo! Good morning!
And also with us, Christy Brandon. She's Chief Development Officer of Hubbard House, one of the groups that will stand to benefit. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
All right. And there's a Rosie the Riveter icon on your website to promote this, which is so great, Donna. That is such a cool way to talk about this.
Well, you know, it's positivity, right? It's we can do this, and we have been doing this. It's our fourth year. We partner with Deutsche Bank and several other companies, such as Interline and APR Energy and Paul Davis Restoration. And lots of companies have chipped in. It's just a real coming together of community and our desire to lead the way as women in this community with leadership skills and big hearts to make a difference. We're proving it's growing every single year, Melissa. It's fantastic.
Yes. And this is coming up Saturday, February 3rd, where volunteers will fan out all over town and work on projects. Now, Christy, one of the projects will be for Hubbard House. What will people be doing?
Well, at Hubbard House, we've been fortunate to be part of GenWorks for since its inception. And we've done a number of great projects, beautification projects that help our residents who are victims of domestic violence feel welcome. This year, we're really excited because the GenWorks volunteers are going to help us raise community awareness. And that's really important because with domestic violence, one in three women are affected. And in 2016, there were 7,000 incidents of domestic violence in Duval County. So it's pervasive in our community. So community awareness mm-hmm. is so important. And so our volunteers are going to be helping us celebrate survivors, helping us create signage that we can help share our message about Hubbard House and the services. And also to help celebrate survivors because we're so proud of them.
Right. And such a great cause. And Donna, as I look on Eventbrite, there are so many projects. So whatever your passion is, people can just search Generation Works 2018 on Eventbrite and they can find anything they like to participate in, everything from Youth Crisis Center to Blessings in a Backpack, Sulzbacher Center, Rethreaded, Feeding Northeast Florida, Friends of Heaven Park, Habajacks, Children's Home Society. There are projects going on with all of these and more.
It's right. And it's great as we've expanded. We've always been focused on downtown and we still have a huge emphasis on downtown. I personally loved raking leaves last year at Heming Park, but we're going to be in the beaches. We're at Jacksonville Beach. We're at Atlantic Beach. And we're even going to be down in St. Augustine. So we love this idea of all of parts of our communities connecting hands and making a difference. And, you know, some of that, of course, we have great leadership and ambassadors. We want to thank Molly Curry, who has been also with us since the beginning, a great energizing force in supporting our community. Darnell Smith is another ambassador from Florida Blue. And City Council President Anna Broche, all really great leaders who say, listen, we believe in making our neighbors and helping them, underpinning them, and helping them create better lives. And also about the leadership of women. I don't know, you know, you would appreciate this, Melissa. If you looked at the percentage of women's leadership at our not-for-profits, and you can say that our not-for-profit work in any community is about building our spirit, our soul, and our sustainability from its foundations, over 90% of those leaders are women in this community.
That's right.
And what does that say?
Yeah. And, you know, of course, Generation W, which you founded, is all about promoting women leaders. And you, not only have you started that, you started Generation WOW, which is a leadership program for young girls. And with this, Generation Works, you've expanded this to a day of service. So this is something that you've really expanded so beautifully in a number of ways. And let's also make a point of saying that you want men and boys to not feel that they can, you want to include everyone in this.
Listen,
day
I am
service.
The mother of two sons. I'm married to M.G. Orender, and we have lots of household discussions about what makes community great, what helps people fulfill their personal mission in life, and working together is where it's at. And that's what we want to do. And I wanted to say also, for young teen girls, their designated site, you know, there's issues in terms of insurance here. So we are at Feeding Northeast Florida with their mentors. So we have a Gen WOW designated site, and I'm excited about that. Also want to say hello to Jeff Edwards at CBEST, because he always is listening to you.
And so he's a great guy.
And so we just want to make sure he keeps listening to you.
He's a great guy. Now, Christy, you know, this is a way that, whether it's Hubbard House or any other nonprofit, people, you know, I think people have such big hearts and they want to help, but they don't always know how. And maybe they don't have money to donate necessarily. This is an easy way people can help out and maybe even make some new friends.
That's right. What I love about Gen W, Gen Works, is that it helps connect people together. It helps take on important issues and take action about them. And that's what I love about GenWorks. For nonprofits, we have limited resources, but we don't have limited resources when we have abundance because of these volunteers. So we're so excited that they're coming. They're absolutely going to have a great time and meet lots of wonderful people.
And it's also there's also a legacy here also, right? So people get exposed to these not-for-profits and then they build relationships. So Deutsche Bank now has a 4-year relationship with these schools. Melissa, you walk in, like their atriums are redone now and there's classrooms being redone and they're present during the course of the year. Absolutely. And so that's also so nice. And we love helping Hubbard House and their incredibly vital work, because violence against women is just unacceptable.
All right. So it's coming up. This is coming up, Generation Works, the 4th annual event. And all you got to do is go to Eventbrite, search Generation Works 2018, and find your project. Volunteer, sign up, and be part of this. Easy to do, and it's a lot of fun. She's Generation W founder, Donna Orender. Christy Brandon is Chief Development Officer of Hubbard House. Ladies, thanks so much. And I know there'll be a lot of people out on that Saturday. So,
Melissa, we so appreciate your leadership every single day. So thank you so much.
Thank you both. All right. A quick break, and in a moment, we're going to spotlight the top teachers in Duval County. Stay with us.
It's a busy time for black superheroes. The TV series Black Lightning had a solid premiere last week. He's the latest high-profile African-American hero taking on social themes. We'll meet the showrunner of Black Lightning, Salim Akil, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times reporter John Leland talks about his year-long assignment following six New Yorkers age 85 and older. At the time, Leland was 55, recently divorced, starting a new relationship, and serving as the main caregiver for his 86-year-old mother. His new book is about what he learned about old age, dealing with decline, and facing death. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
You know how there are certain things you just remember? For us economic types, 10 years ago this week is one of them.
It's not like where were you when Kennedy was shot kind of thing. But as a historian, I can tell you that it was an extraordinary day.
I'm Kai Rizdal. How a Federal Reserve decision on interest rates helped shape the past 10 years in this economy. That is next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. From the State House to the Everglades to the Panhandle, Florida has a unique story.
So join us every Friday for the Florida Roundup.
And hear from newsmakers, journalists, and Floridians from all across the state.
About the issues that matter to you.
The Florida Roundup, Fridays at 1 on WJCT. All right, welcome back. Well, finally, this hour every year, the Jacksonville Public Education Fund celebrates the best teachers in Duval County. The top five finalists will be eligible to participate in a tailored summer fellowship program. The 2018 Teacher of the Year will be announced February 2nd at the Eddy Awards at the Hyatt Regency, and the winner goes on to compete at the State Award Ceremony. We are welcoming right now Zach Champagne with Jax Peff. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Melissa.
And two of the local finalists, Stephanie Bellino from Garden City Elementary School. Hey, Stephanie.
Good morning.
And Will Smith. He teaches at Mayport Coastal Sciences Middle School.
Good morning.
All right. In a moment, we'll talk to these amazing young teachers. But first, Zach, the Eddy Awards is a way to really honor the most incredible young, well, of all ages, the best teachers in town. It's such a nice way to spotlight the hard work of these teachers.
Yeah, the work that our teachers do here in Duval County is really incredible. And we're so honored at JPEF to have this time to celebrate the 177 school-level Teachers of the Year. We'll be doing that on Friday, February 2nd at the Hyatt Regency. The night is intended to elevate and empower all of our school-level Teachers of the Year and really all of the teachers in Duval County for the incredible teaching and learning that's happening in our schools.
Okay. Stephanie Bellino, you're a finalist. You teach at Garden City Elementary.
Yes, I do.
What grade do you teach?
So I teach fifth grade this year, fifth grade reading.
And how do you think you made it to the finals? What's your teaching style in the classroom?
I think I engage my kids, and that's one thing that they have really taken to. And so you are always doing something exciting or making learning fun. And so they've really, you know, shown through that.
And Will Smith, you're a teacher at Mayport Coastal Sciences Middle School. Congratulations to you as well.
Thank you.
And, you know, as a male teacher in particular, teaching is a profession that's female dominated. And for a male teacher, young men don't have a lot of male role models in the classroom. So I think it's particularly exciting to have a male teacher honored in this way for your excellence. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing in the classroom?
Well, my class is a little bit different than most. I teach agri-science at a coastal science middle school, so we do a lot of aquaculture. We learn a lot about fish and our coastal environment and how our human impact also affects that environment, and we try to use a hands-on kind of exploratory approach to do that.
Okay. And let me ask you both, too, as a follow-up. The teaching profession is gotten beaten up, I think it's fair to say, with standardized testing, funding cuts. It can be tough sometimes to be a teacher. So how gratifying is it to be tapped for this, hopefully be honored in this way?
Yeah, I think that, you know, this whole process has really made my kids feel like they matter outside of the four walls of my room. And so, you know, I'm just honored to be able to be a part of this whole process and bring them along with me.
Yeah, I would definitely echo the same sentiment as Stephanie. It's really an honor to be selected and kind of highlighted for what we do every day, especially in light of what you just said.
And with the Jacksonville Public Education Fund's mission of promoting excellence in public education's act, this just sort of goes along with that.
That's right. I mean, we're in the business of honoring and empowering the great teaching and learning that's happening in Duval County. And this event is just one of the many things that we do, but it's our biggest event. And we're just so excited for the opportunity to celebrate all of them and the incredible work that they do each and every day in Duval County Public Schools.
Now, the top five finalists, including Will and Stephanie, they will, even if they don't win, they still get to do some cool stuff. There's a fellowship program, and what else?
So our five finalists this year are going to be participating in a summer fellowship, a two-week fellowship, in which we'll be taking them to Las Vegas to a national conference where we'll have a shared experience together. And then we'll come back, and then they'll work in the JPF offices with us for a week where we're going to let them chase their passion. So as you hear, like Will and Stephanie, just two of our finalists, are very different in the work that they do. And so we're going to be setting up meetings with school board members, city council members, things that we can help to do to elevate and empower the individual work that they do each and every day.
And so that everybody knows all of the names of the finalists, in addition to Stephanie and Will, the other finalists are Abe Riesing at Mandarin High School, Alicia Lloyd with Youth Development Programs, and Tabitha Cox at Sadie Tillis Elementary. You're going to announce the Duval County Teacher of the Year at your gala at the Hyatt, Friday, February 2nd. And then the Duval Teacher of the Year goes on to compete for a state award. What does that person get?
That's great. Yeah, so our winner here in Duval County will go on to compete for the 2019 Florida Teacher of the Year. And that person actually takes a year off, a year sabbatical, represent the state of Florida as the Our Teacher of the Year. They go to events all around the country, but particularly give lots of talks and lots of conversations around the state about teaching and learning and how important it is.
Excellent. Well, kudos to you all and good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for teaching the kids so well. They are finalists Stephanie Bellino from Garden City Elementary School, Will Smith, who teaches at Mayport Coastal Sciences Middle, and Zach Champagne with the Jacksonville Public Education Fund. Again, the Eddie Awards Gala is coming up at the Hyatt Friday, February 2nd. Go to jackspef.org for more. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board, and the show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chepchik. You can download our app to listen to our podcasts, and our rebroadcast airs every night at 8 o'clock. Next on 1A, should evangelicals get to evangelize through healthcare? I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.